Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 22nd day of February 2020. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And since this was quite a busy week, let's kick off our review with a Wuhan, maybe, global pandemic summary. Mostly in the form of some headlines and details that basically just keep getting repeated. First, from Daisy Luther at the Organic Prepper, the quarantine of passengers, she warned yesterday, on the Diamond Princess cruise ship drew towards an end when several hundred people were allowed to disembark. And she asked the important question, we'll get to the answer in a second, is it just possible that all the Diamond Princess quarantine accomplished was to infect more people with the Wuhan COVID-19 coronavirus, and that the aftermath of the poorly executed quarantine will now allow people to spread the virus all across the globe? Especially when you remember that cooping people up in tiny quarters with a shared ventilation system is probably an ideal way to make sure that the virus actually spreads within that population. Well, on to the follow-up. Citing unidentified government officials in Japan, as they begin the second day now of offloading passengers and crew from the Diamond Princess ship that's been under quarantine near Yokohama, Japanese press is reporting that two passengers from the ship have died. And they've added 79 more confirmed cases aboard the ship on Wednesday, bringing the total number of infected, if you've got a stopwatch, to 621, making it the largest outbreak outside mainland China. And even the Center for Deadly Contamination is finally questioning the wisdom of Japanese officials. Now remember, these are the same folks that brought you Fukushima, and accused them of failing to properly quarantine the ship, particularly after 14 passengers were found to be carrying the virus and allowed onto a U.S. evacuation flight. And a follow-up next from Zero Hedge, just hours after Japanese press reports claiming that two passengers had contracted COVID-19 aboard that cruise ship and died, that was confirmed by Japanese authorities, South Korea has reported its first fatality, while one of its major cities now asks citizens to stay inside and avoid venturing outdoors, according to none other than the WAPO. They're calling it an unprecedented crisis. Totalitarian communist China, maybe I repeat myself, has long ago moved way beyond that. A story from IntelliHub and Shepard Mbella says, and we've heard this repeated elsewhere anyway, Chinese authorities now weld residents into their apartments and leave them for dead, as confirmed by new video footage, which means that life in that very much forced quarantine only lasts until all food, water, and supplies run out. And maybe this should sound familiar. In other words, if the virus doesn't kill you, the regime probably will. From Bloomberg, so take it with the usual grain of salt, like you would other Chinese releases. As cases mount, says the headline, Japan is rapidly becoming a coronavirus hotbed. Yes, it begins. Japan is emerging as one of the riskiest places on the planet now for the spread of the coronavirus, prompting criticism that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government has misfired. They're now pushing towards 100 cases and are tied with Singapore for the outside of China lead. And no, those numbers don't include the cruise ship. And from within China, there are of course more and more reports like this, confirmed by multiple sources, including most recently Mike Adams, that says China invokes Holocaust horrors as 40 mobile incinerators, ovens in other words, have been deployed in Wuhan, labeled of course in Chinese for the disposal of animal corpses. But they probably work on big two-footed animals as well. Now remember, folks, satellite imagery of sulfur dioxide plumes in the Wuhan area as well as further west have essentially indicated this was going on for some time now. But what these stories seem to indicate is that there's less and less of an attempt to even hide it. Each incinerator can handle about 5 tons of material per day, equivalent essentially to about 16 dead human bodies and their effects, meaning the total admitted capacity now is about 640 human corpses daily, which is of course quite a bit higher than the official numbers. And that, in turn, has been confirmed by more and more Chinese people willing to speak out, in spite of the draconian sanctions against it. One of them, courtesy of Mike Adams and Zero Hedge, says, in part, "Only normal citizens are suffering. The government doesn't care about us. We can't buy medicine with money. We can't go to the hospital with money." She goes on to say she supports Hong Kong independence, as well as Taiwan, because, basically, no one there can speak freely, and if they do, they're detained. So she talks about sacrifice being necessary for a revolution. "I know it's dangerous for me to speak out," says the woman, "but I can't take it anymore. I cannot. No beds, no medicine. All the news from TV is a lie. In this evil society, I can no longer keep my mouth shut. No one is willing to speak out. I'm going to stand up and make a voice. We really have to resist, my fellow citizens. I can't live like this anymore. And as Communist China continues to escalate this gulag mentality, your host suggests, there'll be more and more people realizing they've got nothing else left to lose. Which inclines your host next to go to a related piece, courtesy of Ethan Huff at Natural News, and it's a bit of an I told you so. A couple of weeks back, it begins Zero Hedge. You may recall this, we talked about it on this show, was banned from evil Twitter for supposedly spreading fake news about the Wuhan coronavirus being a potential bioweapon that escaped probably from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, or WIV, and China's only biosafety level 4 lab. Well, guess what? Now it seems the waste-stream media, perhaps since they can't hide it anymore, is finally getting around to reporting the exact same thing. But this time it's okay, because now it's their authoritative voices that are finally reporting it. And just why, asks Natural News, is the waste-stream now reluctantly beginning to admit what the rest of us have been talking about for weeks? Well, part of the reason may be the fact that the WIV itself in Wuhan issued a memorandum to all of its employees back on January 2nd, forbidding them to publicly release any information about the Wuhan coronavirus, now called COVID-19, presumably because doing so would have then quickly linked everything right back to them. Kind of makes your host wonder how long it took for big socialist media, via their Chinese puppet masters, to get that same message. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who they've previously reported was among the first public figures, anyway, to call out Communist China for apparently having released the deadly synthesized virus, is now publicly claiming that the regime is refusing to hand over evidence about the Wuhan coronavirus that does, in fact, link it to work being done at the BSL-4 bioweapons lab. And during an appearance on Fox News, he told Maria Bartiromo that new evidence he's seen confirms that COVID-19 didn't come from that seafood market, as originally claimed, but rather from this high-level Chinese lab. Most of the stuff that Cotton reported we've already talked about here for days, if not weeks, at this point, but he did note that China is engaging in, quote, duplicity and dishonesty about the situation while being very secretive about what actually happens inside their lab. Not that we'd honestly expect anything otherwise, by the way. Which brings me to yet another story reported by Mike Adams, but not yet at least worthy of coverage by the authorities in the waste stream. They have a bombshell, he writes, smoking gun evidence that the COVID-19 Wuhan coronavirus was specifically engineered as an offensive biological weapon of warfare designed explicitly to target human beings. A new study just published in the peer-reviewed journal called Antiviral Research, Volume 16, April of 2020, is entitled The spike glycoprotein of the new coronavirus 2019 nCoV contains a furin-like cleavage site absent in COV of the same clade, unquote. Meaning that this particular coronavirus contains unique features allowing it to function as a more efficient weapon system explicitly for human-to-human transmission. And that helps explain why the virus has been impossible to contain, even under so-called quarantine conditions, which have universally failed in China, and now Japan, Korea, and elsewhere. And as the authors explain in the text, this furin-like cleavage site may provide a gain of function to the 2019 nCoV for efficient spreading within the human population. And furthermore, they state that there is no known viral ancestry of the COVID-19 coronavirus, meaning it simply didn't evolve from nature. It must be engineered, and the science paper authors also state the virus contains elements from MERS, stating, before the emergence of 2019 nCoV, this important feature was not observed in the lineage B of beta coronaviruses, unquote. And just in time to kind of tie a ribbon around all of that, we have this from Socialist UK via Paul Joseph Watson and Summit News. Patients deemed to be racist, he says, or homophobic, and guess who decides that, will be denied care in National Health System sick trust hospitals under new rules that are set to take place in April, and probably not on April Fool's Day. Currently, says Sky News, staff can refuse to treat non-critical patients who are verbally aggressive or physically violent towards them, but these new protections will extend to any harassment, bullying, or discrimination, including homophobic, sexist, or racist remarks, unquote. And arguably, that means you better leave your Bible at home if you're ever in a UK hospital. This, says Watson, may even be worse than China's socialist credit score, which hasn't yet, at least, so far as we know, gone so far as to punish people by withdrawing medical treatment if they engage in wrongthink. Well, I guess if they do, in Wuhan anyway, they may not live to tell about it. And it looks like Britain is treading that same path. Come to think of it, though, they might actually be more inclined to make you take a pledge to Allah than the communist Chinese, even. All of which leads me next to a theme that I've explored before, but I think is certainly worth reiterating here, the observation that truth is the first casualty of war. And obviously, that includes pandemics, too. Doug the Uncola Lynn, writing via the Burning Platform, has a piece up entitled The Pluses and Minuses of Perceived Slyness, Stuff Sinuses, and Coronaviruses. He begins by noting he's no doctor, but we've all seen the movies. Yeah, folks, booga, 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 be afraid, be very afraid, and all of that. And while he doesn't quote the evil Rahm Emanuel, I will. You never want to let a serious crisis go to waste, and it doesn't look like they intend to this time either. What if, asks the Uncola, Americans, through various propaganda media outlets, have now been pre-programmed to embrace this deception and, furthermore, forfeit what's left of their freedoms in the name of safety? And yeah, we remember Ben Franklin's quote. What, in other words, if coronavirus is the new terrorism? Cue the UN Special Contingency Team. He goes through a whole lot of evidence in the popular press to back up that assertion, noting as well how many people die from other diseases that don't get the booga 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 hype that the latest global pandemic candidate does, from flu, heart disease, smoking, to plain old garden variety pneumonia, but suggests it really does appear that coronavirus, with a registered trademark, remember that little R in the circle? May have all the makings of a massive media event, a post-impeachment, just-in-time delivery to the people, because, he says, dear readers, we're hamsters in a cage, and electronic media is the wheel. Yeah, any way you slice it, coronavirus, R, is about establishing control. And that includes not only quarantines, but, of course, eventually, high-profit vaccinations. And yes, he agrees, and so does your host, healthy immune systems have a far better chance of fighting off any virus than people perhaps do of surviving the likely depopulation measures of quarantines and vaccinations, not to mention the ensuing hysteria and economic impacts. So, he says, as a global plague, you have to admit, maybe coronavirus R seems a bit inadequate, in spite of all the electronic hysteria to the contrary, and particularly as reported from a tightly controlled communist nation. But for the sake of argument, let's just say coronavirus R really was mutating into a bona fide global pandemic. You have to ask the old Latin question, qui bono? Because as the panic exponentially expands, individual rights will, of course, greatly contract, and seemingly just in time, as is happening now. Indeed, he says, everything about this latest coronavirus R outbreak stinks to high heaven, which leads to the obvious question, why would any rational person trust government officials, experts, and the truly Orwellian media, especially when history has proven their predisposition towards subversive slyness, as he puts it? I would say outright lies, but let's give him that one. Maybe this blogger's just simply witnessed too many misdiagnoses before. And at least for now, the death rate from healthy skepticism remains far lower. So, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Either way, we'll know soon enough. Especially, folks, as your host has said for quite some time, Americans wake up to empty shelves at Walmart. Meanwhile, though, the headlines, oh, the headlines, says Dave the Uncola, they just keep a-coming. You've heard them. I'm going to skip over all of that. But the bottom line is this, and it's a good question. Is coronavirus, with the registered trademark, the real deal? A made-for-TV psyop? A marketing gimmick? A man-made bioweapon? Or an outright biblical plague? And hey, folks, I'll add one more. Could it be all of the above? But in any case, says Dave, at this point, what real difference does it make? To some extent, science and health writer John Rappaport asked very similar questions, but from a much more scientific frame of reference. essentially pointing out that if you don't understand high-tech bioresearch, or terms like molecular markers, reverse transcriptase enzymes, and retroviruses, whether contaminated with cellular debris or not, or even electron microscopy, how do you know some of these folks aren't just plain woofing you? Or maybe sometimes they just plain make mistakes and don't understand proper testing for contaminants. He even spends quite a bit of time with the scientific debate about whether, I hope you're sitting down, HIV even exists or not, given the dearth of evidence via electron microscopy, in part via an interview by Cecilia Farber with Dr. Etienne de Harvin, who's unmasked problems associated with HIV research, and says that the heresy of questioning the existence of HIV is because, quote, 100% of AIDS research funding is based on the dogmatically postulated existence of HIV. If HIV does not exist, it would follow that AIDS research is the most appalling case of total misappropriation of public research funds. And it would also follow that monumental amounts of money so far exclusively devoted to HIV would be much better used in other directions. All of which lead Rappaport back to asking some of those very same questions, but from a slightly different angle, especially now, given the idea of large-scale testing of Americans to see whether or not they have, booga, 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 the dreaded disease, and thus need to be quarantined or maybe force-vaccinated. He goes through the details of two different types of tests, but basically says the prospect of them being done on Americans is not comforting, to say the least, because people will be roped into believing they are epidemic cases and therefore need to be isolated and probably treated with highly toxic antiviral drugs, and in the event that they do eventually become ill from the drugs, they'll be told the coronavirus is what done it. And in some cases, this will result in even further dosing with the same drugs at higher levels. And you can imagine what that'll lead to. A very small percentage of doctors, says Rappaport, are aware of the profound shortcomings of these two diagnostic tests now being widely proposed. Most of them, though, will shrug off those doubts and perform the tests anyway, because refusal would endanger their careers and medical licenses. And this, he says, is the sordid drama now unfolding in the American landscape. Oh, and it's not just America. These same tests are being done all over the world. After all of that, I guess it's time for a bit of good news anyway, on two fronts. The first one, the medical front, or at least it will be. Switzerland, says a piece from Michael Alexander at Natural News, and their environmental agency has actually announced a national moratorium on 5G. It's indefinite, and yes, it has to do with the obvious potential health concerns. In its moratorium, BAFU, the Swiss Federal Office for the Environment, has said it cannot yet provide universal criteria without further testing of the impact of 5G radiation on human health. But it's not unmitigated good news. They still want to see the adaptive antennas in real-world operational conditions, and the new letters being released only attempt to set out how the country's cantons can proceed with the permitting of 5G and adaptive antennas until enforcement aid on the structures is available. And meanwhile, this may be the better news, there are currently five proposals for legally binding referendums on the use of 5G that are in motion in Switzerland. Two have already been formalized and only need to collect 100,000 signatures in order to get on the official ballot. And at least one of them seeks to make telecom companies legally liable for any damage their radiation causes, while the second proposes strict and stringent limits on radiation emissions, as well as gives local residents the power to veto new antenna and mast constructions in their own vicinity. So at least, folks, there may be some increased awareness of what they're being exposed to, whether they, up until now, knew it or not. And let's not forget, the way things are going, socialist media may eventually decide to ban actual information about those hazards as well. More good news, this time from the far-left propaganda fest masquerading as debates about who will next run your life better than you can. Courtesy of several sites, including the New York Post and Zero Hedge, and of course, the debates at the Paris Las Vegas Hotel last night among the Democrat contenders for Führer. The headline from the New York Post may have summed it up the best. Concerning the super nanny wannabe, they wrote, Black and Bloom. Democrat debate turns nasty, and said Warren leads brutal Mike beatdown, as the billionaire's self-bankrolled presidential bid was torn to shreds in the opening minutes of Wednesday's Democrat debate, as his opponent skewered him for his checkered past on sexual harassment, and his record on stop and frisk, as if they actually cared about the Fourth Amendment. Well, there were no clear winners, says Tyler Durden's summary, although the self-righteous sodomite hypocrite may have come out, quote, the least scathed. There was at least a clear loser, billionaire Mike Bloomberg, who saw his odds collapse in real time, even if there seemed to have been some financial shenanigans going on intra-debate. But by the end, Bolshevik Bernie had extended his lead, and Michael Bloomberg was relegated back to the status of also-ran. Right out of the gate, the billionaire gun banner was under attack, with none other than Pocahontas landing the first punch, making the former mayor of the Big Apple squirm visibly and roll his eyes in frustration. Quote, I'd like to talk about who we're running against, she said from the Paris Theater, a billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, she admitted, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. She did not point out that if she was talking about a, quote, lying dog-faced pony soldier, she would have been talking about Creepy Joe. It didn't stop there, as even the former vice president, who is in no position to do anything of the sort, still attacked Bloomberg for throwing, quote, close to 5 million young black men up against a wall while he was mayor of New York City, courtesy of his anti-Fourth Amendment stop-and-frisk policy. Even the Minnesota senator nobody's really heard of, Amy Klobuchar, tried to get in a lick, accusing Bloomberg of hiding behind his TV ads. Pocahontas then attacked him over his record of sexist comments and challenged him to release women from non-disclosure agreements with his company, Bloomberg LP, so they could openly discuss, kind of like we saw them use against you-know-who, any claims of sexual harassment. Bloomberg said, we've had very few non-disclosure agreements, and Warren asked, how many is that? Let me finish, said the blowhard. None of them accused me of doing anything other than, maybe they didn't like a joke I told, unquote, provoking an audible groan from the assembled leftists. Even Bernie Sanders decided he didn't like being called a communist by the likes of Bloomberg, although, perish the thought, socialism generally leads to the totalitarian curse thereof. He said, quote, let's talk about democratic socialism, not communism, Mr. Bloomberg. That's a cheap shot. But hey, Bernie, doesn't that really pretty much sum up this whole charade? Because the truth is, you are a communist, and as this and literally every other socialist debate has proven, ultimately, it's all about totalitarianism. But it was President Trump, notes Tyler Durden, that was probably the biggest gainer overall, gleefully mocking Bloomberg, saying in a tweet, quote, Minnie Mike's debate performance tonight was perhaps the worst in the history of debates, and there have been some really bad ones. He was stumbling, bumbling, and grossly incompetent. And he followed that up by saying, if this doesn't knock him out of the race, nothing will. Maybe the high point, though, was this. As Robert Wenzel put it, there was very little in terms of substance. It was all about candidates sparring over details of various interventionist programs, a.k.a. totalitarianism. But it became perhaps most absurd when the six statists on the stage debated the so-called differences between socialism, communism, and capitalism, as if they even had a clue. And here, Bloomberg made his only cogent statement of the night. Not taking it lying down, he kicked in with at least a bit of rationality and said amidst the hubbub, quote, I can't think of any way to get Americans to re-elect Donald Trump other than for them to listen to this conversation. This is absurd. And that, notes just about everybody, was probably the most honest thing spoken during the so-called debate. And it seems even the bookies agree, because as Zero Hedge points out, the odds of a Donald Trump victory in November went up dramatically as of last night. So let's close today with a bit more totalitarian chicanery from the Ministry of Propaganda. The WAPO, says a summary from Michael Krieger, Zero Hedge, and others, is taking heat over a Tuesday op-ed authored by Marquette University political science professor, Julia Azari, entitled, It's Time to Give the Elites a Bigger Say, what, than they already have, in choosing the president. I guess she likes Mike. The Democrat primary process is just too complicated for the peons, and maybe it should be placed instead in the hands of politicians. But after the outrage ensued, the WAPO changed their headline to something far less inflammatory, prompting Michael Krieger to say, there's a reason I take screenshots. Others noted the irony, to put it mildly, of this bit of pap appearing right below their democracy dies in darkness puffery. But that prompted Mike Cernovich to come right out and get to the heart of the matter. He simply said, "The media hates you." And not only have we seen one more dramatic proof from the WAPO, who obviously still think they are the elites that get to do the choosing, but they're still trying to rub the little people's noses in it.
Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, how do you believe?
Take me out to the black, tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea, you can't take the sky from me.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And whether your host likes it or not, we do have to start off this segment with a few of those signs of the times stories. And literally how far down the rotating porcelain pony America has already gone, especially when it comes to wannabe dictators. In this case, a reprobate whose only claim to fame, literally, is that he's an open sodomite, who pretends he knows more about the Bible than people who've actually read it. And obviously that goes for the Constitution, too. Do you know yet who I'm talking about? Here's another hint. He was asked at a CNN town hall on Tuesday night how he was going to deal with the almost certain flood of personal attacks based on your sexual orientation. And he responded, "Well, it'll happen, and I'm ready." Whereupon he urged patience for people who, quote, "haven't quite found their way all the way to the right side of history," unquote. And, of course, the opposite side of Scripture, but who cares about that anymore? Saying, it's important to beckon them in the right direction.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Referring to a comment from Rush Limbaugh recently, who said, quote, "America's still not ready to elect a gay guy kissing his husband, sick, on the debate stage." The mayor of that failed Indiana town poked fun at, quote, "the idea of the likes of a Rush Limbaugh or Donald Trump lecturing anybody on family values," saying, "Sorry, but one thing about my marriage, sick, is it's never involved me having to send hush money to a porn star after cheating on my spouse, sick." CNN also asked the only candidate whose religion they respect if he thought it was possible to be a Christian and support President Trump. Whereupon, and if you haven't figured it out by now, yeah, Mayor Butt is Gay said, quote, "I cannot find any compatibility between the way this president conducts himself and anything I find in Scripture," unquote. And that's particularly revealing, folks, since he can't manage to find all the obvious prohibitions against what he calls marriage in Scripture any more than he can find the prohibitions about what he wants to do with your firearms in the Bill of Rights. Well, come to think of it, as a socialist, he doesn't even seem to understand thou shalt not steal. I'm going to call this one a related story, courtesy of MSNBC, and Scott Whitlock of Newsbusters, who says that in the slanted world of Charlotte Alter, the center now is liberal 2020 candidate Pete Buttigieg, and Barack Obama has now made voting an act of love. As the leftist propaganda outlet masquerading as news, MSNBC, brought the Time magazine journalist sick on to explain the state of politics so far as millennials are concerned and how her generation intends to transform America, citing her book, The Ones We've Been Waiting For, which pulls its title from an Obama speech. Where else? Speaking of millennials and their love for the gay Muslim traitor, Alter enthused, quote, "One reason is that Barack Obama was such a transformational figure for people, and he was, for many people our age, the first president that they really got behind." No pun intended. Ugh. "And he made voting into an act of love," unquote. Of course, they consider a pedophile with a four-year-old an act of love, too, so that literally speaks volumes. And it also suggests what they intend to do to America, whether America likes it or not. Oh, and there's this, too. The host explained that democratic socialism is not a scary term anymore for young people, prompting Alter to lecture about how socialism means something different now than it did back in the 1980s, when, as your host puts it, people still understood history. Because things now have gone so far downhill that the gay mayor of South Bend is somehow in the middle, while the occasional cortex is only far enough left. And to some extent, folks, I have to admit, it's true. Alexandria occasional cortex literally makes Joseph Stalin look almost centrist by comparison. if only her groupies actually remembered who that was. Which brings me to a bit of the real world and actual economics, courtesy first of Clive Mond of clivemond.com, as well as Gold Eagle, who does a lot of technical and fundamental analysis of stocks, bonds, money markets, and of course, real stuff like gold, silver, and copper. His piece today says the Baltic Dry, along with copper, oil, technology, and China, all continue to call for a market crash real soon now. He calls them an important range of commodities and leading indicators, which strongly suggest that the seemingly endless bull market in U.S. equities is living on borrowed time and will end sooner rather than later, given how long it's already lasted and how extremely overvalued it's become. And that would be the downturn, which likely, he says, will start with a crash phase. Regardless, he begins with what the eventual impact of the coronavirus pandemic is. U.S. stock markets in particular seem to be in a state of denial about the actual real-world consequences of the Chinese shutdown and the impact on the global supply chain and corporate profitability everywhere. Some elements, he wrote, even seem to be gloating about China's misfortune and predicament, oblivious to the fact that this is going to have a negative impact on almost everyone. He goes on to share reports about people in Southeast Asia concerning the precipitous collapse of global freight as the full impact of China's colossal shutdown impacts across not only their economy, but now, unsurprisingly, the global economy. Port ship handling in Malaysia, Singapore, and Japan is already down 50%. And supply chains across all sorts of industries are collapsing as components made in China simply dry up for everything from cars to iPhones to computers. Says the author, there's never been a global economic disruption on this scale in history. And it's not helping that all attempts at real reporting on the scale of the pandemic are being heavily censored. After some charts, Clive Mond points to the Baltic Dry Index, which your host has followed frequently on this show literally for years, tracking the cost of shipping. The 14-month chart, he says, for the BDI shows that since the start of September, it's plummeted from 2,500 to just above 400, meaning that the cost of shipping is now just about one-sixth of what it was only 5 months ago. And that, says Mond, should tell you about all you need to know concerning the state of world trade. Just don't expect Wall Street to go around posting this chart up on sidewalk billboards. Dr. Copper, too, he says, looks like it may be ready to crack key important support and drop, perhaps steeply, to the next important support level below $2. And yes, he writes, copper's not called Dr. Copper for nothing. Weakness in copper is frequently an early warning sign of an impending recession, or in this case, depression. Which takes me next to a related piece from Zero Hedge about which of those overburdened supply chains are most at risk. And they say, here's the answer in one chart. But now that Apple's broken the seal, it begins, and made it abundantly clear that China's economic collapse, which could push its first quarter GDP into the negative, according to Goldman, as the world's second largest economy grinds to a halt, it's time to take a look at today's just-in-time delivery environment and what the effects might be when the global supply chain simply stops functioning. And conveniently, Goldman Sachs has just published an analysis. There, Spencer Hill, it says, first looks at a historical precedent and found that something somewhat similar, a supply shock, emerged in the winter of 2014-15, and it was a four-month labor dispute affecting West Coast ports, which in turn appeared to meaningfully affect retail spending on consumer goods in the first quarter of 2015, although snowy weather was perhaps a factor as well. So yeah, folks, this one's likely to be a whole lot bigger and more pervasive, but they do make some interesting observations. Like this one. Goldman notes that, quote, long shipping times to the U.S., generally over a month or more by sea, imply that supply chain effects of Chinese production shortfalls might not fully materialize until next quarter or even later, at which point above-trend Chinese production or import substitution from other countries might be able to mitigate some of the impact. So that's the good news. The bad news is, Goldman found that nearly a third of Chinese products arrive by air. And by value, that includes about three-quarters of all telecom hardware, with those goods representing 3.6% of U.S. retail sales and just under 1% of total personal consumption expenditures. And as such, they represent the sector most likely to be impacted as China remains paralyzed. Not surprisingly, air freight imports are skewed towards high-value, lightweight products like smartphones, laptops, and consumer electronics, which represent a perfect storm for a company such as Apple that's reliant on all three. And additionally, a significant share of apparel and footwear, about 10%, also arrive from China by plane. Other big impacts shown on the chart include things like home goods and hobbies, automobiles and parts, and yeah, let's not forget drugs and pharmaceuticals. Dr. Doom, Noriel Rubini, also weighs in today, and it certainly seems appropriate to see what a voice like his might have to say on this topic. In my 2010 book, Crisis Economics, he begins, I define financial crises not as the black swan events made famous by Nassim Taleb in his bestseller, but as white swans, because everybody should have been able to see them coming. The big ones, he says, are more like hurricanes. They're the predictable result of built-up economic and financial vulnerabilities and policy mistakes. I guess it's just the timing and course that remain to be seen. There are times, continues Dr. Doom, when we should expect the system to reach a tipping point, the Minsky moment, when a boom and bubble turn into a crash and a bust. Such events, he says, are not about the unknown unknowns, but rather the known unknowns. And beyond the usual economic and policy risks that most financial analysts try to worry about, a number of potentially seismic white swans are now visible on the horizon. Any of them could trigger severe economic, financial, political, and geopolitical disturbances unlike anything seen since the 2008 crisis. And for starters, he says, the U.S. is locked in an escalating strategic rivalry with at least four implicitly aligned revisionist powers, you know the names, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, all of whom have an interest in challenging the U.S.-led global order. And 2020 could end up being a critical year for them, owing to the U.S. presidential election and the potential change in U.S. global policies that might follow. Yeah, he says, under Trump, the U.S. has been trying to contain or even trigger regime change in these four countries through economic sanctions and other means. Meanwhile, the revisionists want to undercut American hard and soft power by destabilizing the U.S. from within, and we can see that in Congress, via asymmetric warfare. And if the upcoming election descends into partisan rancor, chaos, disputed vote tallies, and accusations of rigged elections, which pretty much seem inevitable, folks, so much the better for America's rivals. And that, of course, includes the communist inside the gate. A breakdown of the U.S. political system, he says, would certainly weaken American power abroad. Moreover, there are a number of countries that have a particular interest in removing Trump because of the acute threat that he poses, for example, to the Iranian regime, meaning that war between the U.S. and Iran is likely this year, and the current calm may be the one before the proverbial storm. When it comes to U.S.-China relations, the current Phase 1 deal is nothing but a temporary band-aid, suggests Dr. Doom. The bilateral Cold War over technology, data, investment, currency, and finance is already escalating sharply, and the COVID-19 outbreak has reinforced the position of those in the U.S. arguing for containment and lent further momentum to the broader trend of Sino-American decoupling. Most immediately, he says, the epidemic is certainly likely to be more severe than currently expected, and the disruption of the Chinese economy will have spillover effects on the, say it with me folks, global supply chains, including Big Pharma, of which China is a critical supplier, along with business confidence, all of which will more likely be more severe than financial markets are currently suggesting by their complacency. And while by definition the current Sino-American Cold War is a low-intensity conflict, a sharp escalation seems likely this year. There's more, he continues. Revisionist powers could also attack the U.S. and Western financial systems, and that's a continuing process, including SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication Platform. Already, he notes, ECB President Christine Lagarde has warned that a cyber attack on European financial markets might cost over $600 billion, while security officials in the U.S. have expressed concerns about similar vulnerabilities. All of which means that by next year, the U.S.-China conflict could have escalated from a cold war to a near hot one. Let's not forget, he writes, that the Chinese regime and economy severely damaged by the COVID-19 crisis and facing restless masses will need an external scapegoat. And who better than Taiwan, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and U.S. naval positions in the East and South China Seas, where confrontation could creep into escalating military incidents. And it could also pursue the financial nuclear option of finally dumping their holdings of U.S. Treasury bonds if escalation does take place. In particular, he writes, China could diversify their currency reserves by converting them into another liquid asset, which is less vulnerable to U.S. primary or secondary sanctions. And you can think what it is, can't you? Yeah, the real stuff, gold. Indeed, both China and Russia, he says, have been stockpiling gold reserves, overtly and covertly, which explains the nearly 30% spike in gold prices since early 2019. Meanwhile, the U.S., of course, won't sit idly by while coming under asymmetric attack. It's already been increasing the pressure on these countries with sanctions and other forms of trade and financial warfare, not to mention its own world-beating cyber warfare capabilities. And U.S. cyber attacks against those four rivals will probably intensify this year, raising the risk of the first ever cyber world war, along with massive economic, financial, and political disorder. So all in all, he concludes, as of early 2020, here's where we stand. The U.S. and Iran have already had a military confrontation that will probably soon escalate. China's in the grip of a viral outbreak that could become a global pandemic. Cyber warfare is ongoing. Meanwhile, majority holders of U.S. treasuries are pursuing their own diversification strategies, while the far-left primary of Democrat rivals is exposing rifts in the opposition to Trump and are already casting doubt on vote-counting processes. Rivalries between the U.S. and those four revisionist powers are escalating, and the real-world costs of real climate change, probably not man-made, but certainly in progress, are mounting. You're already seeing that, folks, in food prices, but just wait. And here concludes Norio Rubini is the poser. Financial markets, meanwhile, remain blissfully ignorant in denial of the risk, convinced that a calm, if not happy, year awaits major economies and global markets. Guess who's probably going to be disappointed? From there, folks, we return back to the issue of people and perfidy. Earlier this week, there were reports, sadly they don't seem to have panned out, that Deep State Attorney General William Barr might actually resign because President Trump's tweets make it, quote, impossible for him to do his job. Some of us thought it might be his puppet masters getting in the way of that. But here's what's come out that was at least kind of funny. In an ABC interview, Barr took a public swipe at the president, saying that his tweets about the Just Us Department cases and staffers make it impossible, as we've already pointed out, for him to do his job. And the next day, Trump ignored Barr's request and insisting that he has the legal right to intervene in criminal cases. He does. It's called the pardon power. And to sidestep the Just Us Department's historical independence. Now that one, I have to admit, is a downright chortler. Because when I think about Just Us Department independence, I can't help but remember Janet Reno, Jack Danforth, and of course Eric Holder, and yeah, Ms. Treason on the Tarmac, Loretta Lynch Mob. Especially when it came to criminal acts that were downgraded to just being matters. Right, James Comey? That kind of independence would still have America being a subject of Great Britain. Here's another thigh slapper from the piece. Considering a resignation from his post, says the AP, suggests that he sees the Just Us Department's reputation as an institution that makes decisions on criminal cases independently, unmoved and unbound by political sway.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
As more important than his so-called allegiance to the president. For his part, the president reiterated that he understood his tweets make Barr's job harder, but he shows no signs of relenting, adding that he still has total confidence in my attorney general, but everybody has the right to speak their mind, unquote. Well, unless, of course, you run afoul of the socialist media, or your name is Roger Stone, or Alex Jones, or Mike Adams, or anybody else that the deep state doesn't really want speaking at all. By the time the week was out, by the way, Roger Stone got a 40-month, or about 3.5-year sentence from Obama's official hatchet girl, Amy Berman Jackson, at least 40 months longer than he should have, which is still about a dozen years less than any real criminal in the FBI, DOJ, CIA, or ETC deserves but won't get. And for another opinion on the same subject, and a couple of interesting observations to boot, we go to James Howard Kunstler via his own website as well as LouRockwell.com in a piece he calls At Stake, apparently referring to the rule of law. A miasma of consternation, he writes, lay heavy across the Potomac swamp late last week when former FBI acting director Andrew McCabe was let off the hook for lying to his own bureau, while elsewhere across D.C., the distinguished Lieutenant General Michael Flynn was still fighting for his life against exactly the same charge, after 3 years of dilatory maneuvers by the DOJ to conceal their prosecutorial malfeasance in this case. And then, of course, the sketchy Roger Stone matter entered a twilight zone of jiggery pokery that appeared to climax in a staged ruse by his four prosecutors, who quit in a hissy fit when they couldn't basically hang the guy. And it looks, says Kunstler, like an attempt to lure Attorney General Mr. Barr into a trap. You might be forgiven, he continues, for failing to follow all the twists and turns in this latest installment of what might now be called Coupgate, a summation of the seditious campaign to overthrow the president, which has already gone through so many different gates, Spygate, Russiagate, Mueller-gate, Ukraine-gate, Whistleblower-gate, that Mr. Trump's starting to look like he spent 3 years training for the giant slalom in the next Winter Olympics. A localized civil war, though, says Kunstler, is underway in the Department of Just Us now, and Mr. Barr is in the middle, getting it from both sides. Apparently, he says, the AG has partitioned the DOJ into two separate realms. And this is really kind of interesting. The now-identified core of coosters working desperately to keep their asses covered in the unraveling conspiracy, and Mr. Barr's group attempting to account fairly for all that's happened. Well, we can only hope, anyway, while salvaging what's left, and there isn't much, of the outfit's institutional legitimacy. Too much documented evidence of real crime is actually out there now in the public domain, says Kunstler, to dismiss these activities as a mere conspiracy theory. The trouble is, so many were involved from so many branches and agencies that fully prosecuting every single angle of the massive crime spree could bring down the permanent bureaucracy like the Jenga tower it's become. And the decision to let infamous Andy skate on the lying rap infuriated those demanding accountability for government lawyers gone wild, since even the DOJ Inspector General, Mr. Horowitz, cited several instances of, to put it mildly, lacking candor in more than one report. And Andy seems to have been the pivot man for the FBI in the early and middle phases of the coup, along, of course, with his infamous DOJ counterpart, former Deputy AG Rod, I'll wear a wire, Rosenstein. I have a theory, says James Howard Kunstler, about the McCabe case. The Attorney General has taken that rinky-dink charge of lying to the FBI off the table. Now, he makes a pretty good point here. Listen to this. It's become a liability, virtually the emblem for government misconduct. And Mr. Barr's just plain getting rid of it. It's already caused too much mischief, insulted American sense of justice, and that's probably an understatement, and damaged the standing of the DOJ. And note, he says, Andrew McCabe has been let off only on this charge, stemming from only one particular referral by the IG, and he may well yet be liable for more serious charges to come. Well, we'll see, folks, and we can only hope. From here on, though, there will be no more rinky-dink lying charges against any of those implicated in the coup, suggests Kunstler, only the most serious charges, and only those that add up to a solid case. Well, he says, this coup has been so broad, so deep, so thick, I predict cases will have to be brought under the RICO statutes in batches for different groups in separate agencies and separate branches of government. Now, here is the interesting list, folks. For example, there is Intel Mob, including former CIA Director Scumbag John Brennan, former Director of National Intelligence, DNI, James Clapper, current Intel IG Michael Atkinson, and the so-called whistleblower, the name that must not be named, Eric, you know it, Sharamella, 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 he puts it all in asterisks here, and the international man of mystery, Joseph Mifsud. There's another gang from the Department of State who helped engineer Ukrainegate, and that would include former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, former Secretary of State John Kerry, and others. There's the big herd of rogue lawyers at the DOJ and its stepchild, the FBI, in names now widely disseminated. You know them. Comey, Strzok, Page, Baker, Buente, Carlin, Kleinsmith, et al. There's Robert Mueller and his henchpersons, Andrew Weissman, Jeannie Rhee, et al. There's another band of seditionists in Congress that includes not only Mark Warner of the Senate Intel Committee, but the notorious idiot, his term, Adam Schiffless, over in the House, and staffers who work for both. There's a bunch in the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment that paid over $1 million to the alternate international man of mystery, actually CIA asset, Stephen Halper, to run entrapment schemes against people working for Mr. Trump. And there, of course, is a swarm from Barack Hussein Obama's White House, including Valerie Jarrett, Susan Rice, Samantha Powers, Alexandra Chalupa, former VP, creepy quid pro Joe Biden himself, and, of course, the former coup plotter-in-chief. And finally, let's not forget the 800-pound gorilla in the room, namely Hitlery herself, those connected to her, and her charity fraud, the Clinton Foundation, which, of course, is the real and actual predicate for the whole sordid affair, a list that includes Viktor Vekselberg of Russia's Skolkovo Project, a $25 million donor, Russian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk, Russian aluminum magnate Oleg Deripaska, and Dmitry Alpervich of CrowdStrike. Hey, anybody really still want to talk about Russia, Russia, Russia collusion? As well as rascally freelancers like Christopher Steele, Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS, the shadowy Nelly Orr, lawyer lobbyist Adam Waldman, and Hitlery Aaron Boyce, Sidney Blumenthal, and Cody Shearer. And the beat goes on. So now, he says, perhaps you can see the scope of this big hot mess and the trouble William Barr might have straightening it out if your host adds he's even serious. About which, it's obviously fair to have our doubts.